for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Advances in technology, from drones to computer networks to biological agents, mean more people than ever before have access to potentially dangerous technologies. In a new book titled The Future of Violence, authors Benjamin Wittes and Gabriella Blum explore these threats and explain why they require a new way of thinking about the state's role in providing security to citizens. Benjamin Wittes is Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. Gabriella Blum is Professor of Human Rights and International Humanitarian Law at Harvard University. And throughout the hour, you are, as always, invited to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Wonderful to be here.
Good to see you both. Gabriella Blum, on the cover of The Future of Violence is a figure of a spider in the lower right-hand corner and an artificial or drone spider in the upper left-hand corner. Explain this spider in the shower.
So a possible hypothetical for the future, and it's not a distant future, is that you walk into your shower and you find a spider. And that spider could either be a real spider, or it could be a robot spider or a mini drone. And this spider could be sent by a former spouse or a business competitor, and it could either survey you and post pictures of you naked online, or it could assassinate you. And one of the ways this topic or the discussion really emerged between Ben and myself was the thought that people talked a lot about targeted killings in Pakistan, in Yemen, the government sending drones to kill suspected terrorists. And that was an important conversation, no doubt. But for me, it missed a very important element of the conversation, which was this is not a weapon that is solely going to be a government monopoly. There's no reason to suspect or to think that drones will be only the province of governments, certainly not just the U.S. government. We know that at least 45 other countries now have robots in their military establishment, but that you and I and everyone we know can have easily access to these kinds of robots. They are getting more miniatured. They are being developed throughout the defense establishment, academic research facilities, the private sector. They're becoming widely available, very cheap, and very scary. And now the interesting question is not what happens, or not only what happens when the government sends drones to Pakistan, but what happens when you and I and everybody we know have capability to survey and assassinate each other.
And the subtitle of this book, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones, Confronting a New Age of Threat. Ben, it would sound as though there are no defenses against this new world of threat.
Well, so I'm not sure there are no defenses. One of the subjects we take on at length is the structure of defense in this new environment. But it is fair to say that, as the first point, is that the power to attack, and specifically the power to attack over long distances with diminished accountability, because you can't see the person, right? And maybe over across international borders, is definitely proliferating. And you see that in the cybersecurity arena every day, where small groups or individuals are conducting international attacks that were completely impossible only 10 years or 20 years ago. And that's spreading and we believe going to spread to other technological platforms as well.
You know, there was a great deal of humor last month when a drone flew over the White House lawn. You're saying this ain't funny.
No, it's not funny. What is not funny about it is that, sure, it can be used for humorous purposes. And there is a website called DIY Drones that tells you how to build drones. And if you're a hobbyist, you can do that over the weekend. And drones do also serve lots of very useful purposes. They're used by NGOs to monitor refugee flows. They can be used for search and rescue. The kind of challenge of all the technologies we're talking about, bioresearch, cyber, and drones, is that they're all dual use. They can be used for lots of very, very, very good purposes, which is often the case. But there's also this small, not insignificant probability that they're going to be used and are used for very menacing purposes. And that is what makes them not funny.
And one of the things that's really important here is that this is a structure of technological development in general, right? That people develop technologies often for reasons that have only the noblest and most valuable purposes in mind. And somebody else then figures out how to use them as weapons, right? So this is a very, very long history. And these technologies, unlike, say, the nuclear industry or certain types of devoted weapon systems, were really not developed for, with the exception of drones, for weaponizing purposes in mind. A lot of them were developed, by civilians for civilian purposes. But like any technologies that empower people to do great things, they also will empower not so great people to do not so great things over great distances.
We have already seen two attempts at precisely that kind of destruction, one with a shoe bomber flying across the Atlantic, another with plastic bombs strapped to himself. Why is it that these have become harder and harder to detect?
Well, so, first of all, bombing is an old technology, right? The structure of, trying to blow something up to kill people is many hundreds of years old. The cleverness with which people develop new ways to do that, I think, makes you worry about, as biological agents are more and more available, that same resourcefulness that causes people to figure out how to put bombs in shoes, that causes people to design ever harder to detect explosive vests, will migrate to these new technologies that are new means of attacks. There haven't been very many biological attacks yet. There have been some, the anthrax attacks being the most notable. The Aum Shinrikyo in Japan also experimented unsuccessfully in this area. But as more and more people get access to the basic technology, as more and more people get access to the ability to conduct those attacks, I think that same resourcefulness that you see in the engineers who design ever better bombs will start applying in other technological spaces as well.
So the question you end up asking in the book is, how do you govern a state with these kinds of threats involved?
So the first thing to note is that the state itself is not standing still while all these other actors are being empowered. The state also is a great beneficiary of the technological revolution, and at least some governments, the United States government is one, is a great winner in this technological empowerment race. The question is, however, what happens when both the government or some governments are being empowered just as the proliferated threat is becoming so exponentially larger? And so you have this arms race between the state itself and a huge number of potential sources of threats. And then it's unclear who gets to win that arms race or how the state is positioned to guard itself and its citizens against all these threats. If you go back to the spider example, what it also demonstrates is that the lines that we used to think of in traditional ways as distinguishing national security as the realm of state defense against external threats and what we used to think of as ordinary crime is really blurring. So you're not sure what type of threat you're guarding against. And the state now has an obligation to protect every one of its citizens and itself from potentially 7 billion, it's of course an exaggeration, but any number of external sources of threats. And this is the real challenge of we're facing.
The ultimate question the book is concerned with, as you said in your question, is how you govern a world in which anyone in the world can attack anyone else in the world from anywhere in the world.
Benjamin Wittes and Gabriella Blum, they're talking about their new book, The Future of Violence. We'll take a short break here. We do welcome your questions, comments, 800-433-8850.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, offering experiences for grandparents and grandchildren, active outdoor enthusiasts, and others. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from Anchor Bay Entertainment with The Imitation Game, based on a true story about the man who cracked the German Enigma code that helped shorten World War II. Directed by Morton Tilden and starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley. On Blu-ray and DVD, March 31st.
And welcome back. In their new book titled The Future of Violence, Benjamin Wittes and Gabriella Blum talk about the world we live in, a world where anybody can attack anyone anywhere in the world and anyone can be attacked. And they're talking about the origins of a liberal democratic state. You talk about Hobbes and Locke and what they said is fundamental to a liberal democratic state.
So, you know, we think of the state as sort of the natural order of things, but that's actually a relatively recent thing. It only dates from the Enlightenment period. And if you go back to the Enlightenment theoreticians of the state, security and the role of the state in protecting you, both from your fellows who might attack you, but also from external invasion, is central to the legitimacy of the state. It's central to where the idea of the state comes from, that it's what Hobbes called the Leviathan, that we empower, we give it some piece of our liberty in exchange for this promise of protection that will make the rest of our liberty more meaningful. And so the question that we struggle with, and we really struggled with it as we worked on this book, is what happens if between the vulnerability that you experience by having data about you all over the world, the possibility of, you know, biological manipulations in some foreign country could, you know, result in, you know, mass death, including yours here. And the spider, you're not even sure if that's a real spider in your shower, but maybe it's a robot sent from somewhere else. What if the state can't protect you anymore or has a much lesser ability to protect you? Under those circumstances, does the state's source of legitimacy reduce?
But how does that differ from the ordinary violence one would face walking out here on Connecticut Avenue should someone in our so-called free society be carrying a gun and decide you will become his or her target at random?
Absolutely. So this country experiences anything from 13,000 to 17,000 homicides a year. And we accept a certain level of crime that we live with as a cost or a price of living in a free society. But there is a difference. There is a difference of magnitude, first of all. What do you think the incidence of violence or violent attacks is going to be when other people are far more empowered to do things that they're not currently are.
For example, 9/11.
For example, all these new technologies, for example, whether it's North Korea or Al-Qaeda or ISIS or an anarchist group somewhere or a researcher in a lab wants to, or even by accident, spreads a dangerous agent. But there's also an added element, and that is the relevance of borders. The social contract was very much preoccupied with what happens in any single Leviathan and had less to say about the relationship among different Leviathans. So let's talk about one particular example, which is a person in Northern Carolina who was indicted and convicted for sending malware to personal computers of women and young girls. And that malware allowed him to hack their webcams, take surreptitiously pictures of them naked, and then what the FBI called sextort them into making more sex videos for him. Now, this person, this is the only fortunate part of the story, was in Northern California, so the FBI could come knock on his door, arrest him, try him and convict him and send him to prison. Now, what happens when this person is in Nigeria or in Ireland or anywhere else in the world that you want? Who then has the authority, who has the power, who has the capability to really bring them to justice or prevent them from attacking further? And that then makes it very different from the crime down the street.
When you think about the number of possibilities out there, it sort of takes your breath away. You could spend your life in total fear, or you could say to a certain extent, well, the government is in charge. The government has records. The government is keeping track. And the government is conducting inspections of those who board airplanes, say, with cell phones or are creating drones. I mean, can we no longer rely on that form of protection?
Well, so first of all, we have no choice but to rely on that sort of protection. And I don't think Gabby means to argue that government is useless and we shouldn't rely on it. It's still the best thing we have. The state as a entity that is capable of enforcing law, passing law, and carrying it out. On the other hand, one thing that we have really seen over the last 20 to 30 years is the increasing incorporation of the private sector into basic aspects of defense. And this is what we argue in the book. This is the social contract that Hobbes and Locke imagined becoming much more complicated in response to technological development. So let me give you two examples of that. One is sort of hypothetical and the other is very real. The very real example is that all this NSA surveillance that we see, a whole lot of it isn't done by NSA, right? It's done by the internet and tech companies under orders from NSA right. and from the courts. And what NSA has is this mammoth power, but a lot of that power is derivative of the power of your relationship, of the relationship that you have with technology companies. That's not the Hobbesian Leviathan there. That's a much more complicated relationship between consumer, provider, government as regulator. Here's a more hypothetical example. Imagine that the BP oil spill had been the result not of an accident, as it turned out to be, but as a result of a bombing, which was what the government assumed for the first number of hours in response to it. There were a lot of people in government who assumed we were dealing with a terrorist attack. Now, if that had happened, we would have, first of all, recognized it as the most successful terrorist attack on the United States since 9/11. But we would notice something else, too, that I think a lot of people didn't notice, which was that the entity responsible for protecting the shores of the United States from this massive flow of oil was not the Coast Guard, it was not the U.S. Navy, it was not any environmental protection organization. It was a private foreign corporation. And I think that's an interesting metaphor for the role that private entities are playing in our national defense right now. That, you know, you could have millions and millions of barrels of oil spilling onto our coast, and this was essentially subcontracted to clean this up, to stop it, to British Petroleum.
Here's an email from Mike in Baltimore who says, remote control model airplanes and gliders have been around for nearly 100 years. Model helicopters half as long. I'm not buying into the panic about drones being suddenly easy to make or get. If some maniac wanted to put a bomb on a model plane and fly it somewhere, they could have done it decades ago.
That's exactly correct. And our point about drones is not that tomorrow you're going to see a major terrorist attack with a drone. The point is that robotics and networked robotics in particular are a technology and a set of technologies that involve awesome power, like, you know, networked computers, only it's a power to do things in real space. Like all technologies governed by Moore's law, the power is increasing, the costs are coming down, more and more people are going to be able to do more and more powerful things. And we have to ask the question, whenever that's true, what are really bad people going to do? If only good people had firearms, firearms wouldn't be a problem either.
But talk about then that line, that debate between security and threat. I mean, it's always there. How much more can or should the government be doing?
So in a way, Mike's question was about human nature. What do you think people are likely to do when they have a lot of power in their hands? And most people will use it for wonderful purposes. And there is a small minority, but in a world of 7 billion people, a small minority is still a significant threat. So the government does have it, it owes us an obligation to protect us. The question is always how much protection and at what cost. We also want to say there is no 100% security.
Of course not.
And one role of the government is to build resilience. Some of resilience is psychological. And to say, yes, as a free society, we should expect some of these threats to materialize and we should expect to live with them and not be not question everything we believe in because we've experienced one or two or five or ten attacks. The question is incidents, and the question is the magnitude of the threat. And a responsible government needs to prepare for very bad scenarios, and we do expect the government to do so, and we are willing to bear some cost for it.
One thing that, you know, you have to ask whenever you're creating spaces in which people are going to get to do things. Now, these are not physical spaces like a playground or a city street, but they're operational theaters, right? Arenas in which people can build things, people can use technology to get things done. And one thing you have to ask about these spaces is, are they going to be patrolled? Are they going to be governed? Or are they going to be ungoverned? Your first segment today was about Yemen, which is an increasingly ungoverned space and a terrifyingly ungoverned space. And there's something, you know, when we're talking about ungoverned spaces and their physical locations, we understand them to be very terrifying, whether it's the under-patrolled inner-city neighborhood, whether it's Yemen. We expect, in a very sort of Hobbesian, Lockean way, government to be there to create order and to ensure a certain level of order. For some reason, when we talk about virtual spaces, we like the idea of ungoverned spaces. There's a whole community devoted to the idea. It's the dominant community is devoted to the idea of the internet as a largely ungoverned space. One of the things that we're saying is that's actually not a sustainable environment. And, what conclusions you draw from that is a very hard question. But I think one of the things that we believe is that as these technologies of mass empowerment get ever more penetrating into larger numbers of people's lives, there has to be mechanisms of governance of their use. And that involves a certain amount of monitoring.
Tighter security all around, whether it means cameras on each corner, in each plane. Is that what you mean?
Well, so in some areas, surveillance is part of the answer. In some areas, licensing is part of the answer. So think about the automobile for a minute. This is the great technology of mass empowerment of the first half of the 20th century, right? And if you said to somebody in the early part of the century that we were going to put cars going at 70 miles an hour in the hands of tens of millions of people, and that would be largely safe, no one would believe that. That's a crazy idea. But we required licenses. We didn't treat it like firearms, which we said there's a constitutional right, right? We required licenses. We required that you not be anonymous. You have a license plate. You have insurance. And there were laws. And we managed to regulate that technology.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. However, there are licenses, there are laws, there are restrictions on gun ownership, for example. And yet, look at the proliferation of guns, even those belonging to people who do not have licenses, who do not have permission to own them.
So, first of all, there's not a lot of licensing and restrictions here, precisely because as a society, we've decided to anchor the right to bear arms in our Constitution. It wasn't an obvious choice. It wasn't an inevitable choice, but that was the choice that was made. And as a result, there are laxer restrictions here on bearing arms than in many other places around the world. And that is part of the reason why lots of people who shouldn't have access to guns have them, because you can buy them on the street and anywhere else.
So is more surveillance going to help there?
Surveillance is not a panacea. It's not a response to everything. And even when it is, it has to be conducted, so we argue, under very strict conditions and circumstances. When you think about regulation, when you think about restrictions, you want to think about how desirable they are, whether you really want to restrict an action, whether you get it right. You get the balance between banning good things and banning bad things. You get that right. And whether it's effective. And actually, part of the issue with guns today is think about 3D technology. If you have 3D printers and you can print a gun in your basement, then the regulation of gun control becomes that much more problematic, that much more limited in its capacity to ban guns. Now, having said that, surveillance may actually be part of the solution. Other parts of the solution are regulation of private entities. So again, go back to the social contract. The traditional social contract thought about the relationship between the citizen and the government. Now we have a whole host of private sector companies that we need to worry about and that we have expectations to protect us.
Also. Gabriella Blum and Benjamin Wishes, they are co-authors of the new book, The Future of Violence. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Tote Maritime is working to reduce emissions across their fleet by building container ships that run on natural gas. Learn more at thinkaboutit.org. From CFP, on behalf of Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to the highest standard in personal financial advice to help plan for major life events and reaching financial goals, at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll explore the origins of the concept that America is a Christian nation. We talk with Kevin Cruz. His new book, One Nation Under God, How Corporate America Invented Christian America, is about how money, religion, and politics came together to create a story that continues to define and divide American politics. Join us.
Welcome back. Benjamin Wittes and Gabriella Blum are co-authors of a new book. It's titled The Future of Violence, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones, Confronting a New Age of Threat. We're going to open the phones now first to Bloomingdale, Michigan. Joel, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I wonder if the authors have considered that the idea of a new age of violence is sort of a red herring. And I wonder this because what they describe seems to hinge on two things. One, the a leap in potential of violence by new technology, and two, the wider access that people have to it. And the problem I have is that it doesn't really sound new, because people said very much the same thing about the nuclear age, for example. And I realize not everybody has access to a nuclear weapon, but they said much the same thing about handguns. And so I wonder how they consider that in the course of human history, there are, according to Steven Pinker, which I hope you're familiar, has argued there are two real things that stand out. One is that technology has consistently become more and more complex and has had the more and more potential for violence, but also the potential for violence has decreased at the same time. So I wonder if they've taken that consideration and could comment on it.
Right. Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, is really a magnificent history of the decline in violence over millennia, not just centuries. But a central argument in Pinker's thesis is the role of the state. So he believes that the state itself, from the Enlightenment period, so we're talking about three or four centuries, played a very central role in policing people and limiting, reducing violence in between and among and across populations. Pinker doesn't address the question, what happens if the state itself is significantly weakened? What happens when the potential threats proliferate onto untold numbers and magnitudes of populations? You mentioned the nuclear threat. The nuclear threat is very, very, very different. So you don't have access to nuclear materials. This is one area where the government has been incredibly successful in limiting access, in limiting knowledge. There aren't publicly available sources that tell you how to build a nuclear bomb. It's incredibly difficult to do, and that's why proliferation is, we know enough about who's attempting to build what because it's so unusual. It's the exceptional case. If you go online and buy a drone, there isn't any reason for us to know that or monitor, or there isn't a plan in place to monitor millions of people who buy and have access to drones that are not classified, that are cheaply available, that are widely available, that each and every one of us can have with very limited policing powers by the government, whether domestically or internationally.
I hope that answers it. Let's go to Frederick, Maryland. Brian, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I was listening to you describe the government as this leviathan that is charged with protecting the people. You know, even in our country, the government and our founding fathers recognized that at some point they can't protect everyone, which is kind of why I believe we have our Second Amendment right, because, you know, police can't be everywhere. It's the common man that has to protect himself at some point. Now, as technologies come out, it also seems like ways to defend yourself against abuses of that technology came out. Computers came out, and then you have Norton antivirus and McCaffrey's. So wouldn't it go to say that with these technologies being proliferated, ways to protect ourselves will come into play automatically just because consumers recognize, hey, I don't want my neighbor's kid flying their drone over my backyard?
Yeah.
So this is an excellent question, and it's one that we treat at some length in the book. And the cyber arena to which you refer is a really good example of that. So not only are there software companies like, you know, Norton, you mentioned, that allow individual consumers a certain degree of protection, but there's a whole industry that has developed around cybersecurity at the more enterprise level. And that said, every day there is new major data breaches, including by state actors.
North Korea.
Iran has been attacking our financial industry. We have been attacking the Iranian nuclear program. And there's also, at the lower grade, sort of more street crime level, identity theft is a pretty rampant problem, and a lot of people are being victimized. And so I think you have to say at this point, offense is beating defense pretty decisively. And whether that is a permanent state of affairs or we will reach a kind of equilibrium the way we have with certain other technologies, I suspect that is open to debate, I think. I mean, I sort of suspect eventually we'll have a renaissance of defense, but we haven't seen it yet.
What do you say to the idea, the construction of a cell phone, for example, with invisible bomb structure created within it and carried onto a plane? What is there currently in place to protect citizens against that?
Well, so, you know, rightly, TSA and its various sister agencies around the world don't detail their specific security protocols. But look, what they have said is that there are a number of layers of security, some of them very visible. Everybody goes through those screening mechanisms, sure, and some of them much less visible, you know, that involve looking for data patterns, that involve pre-screening people in lines. Now, some of these are controversial, and some of them, you know, for political reasons, and some of these mechanisms are not. I do think, in the United States anyway, airline security has been really a success story, you know, and if you look at the amount of panic in the immediate post 9/11 era, that people were afraid to get on airplanes, and the possibility that that would really have ground you know, a lot of economic activity and leisure activity and travel activity to a halt, it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because through a combination of regulatory activity, screenings, new protocols, and responsiveness to new threats as they developed, some of which were politically controversial and some of which we just learned to live with, we managed to secure the platform that is commercial airline travel to a remarkable degree worldwide.
Do you believe that will continue with the growth of technology and the understanding of foreign players as to how to use that technology?
You know, my old colleague at the Washington Post, Tom Tolles, once drew what I thought was one of just the all-time great political cartoons, which was a single frame of Al-Qaeda's real ideology, and it was, "We hate airplanes." And, you know, there is a huge amount of energy that is intellectual energy that is going into the problem of how to bring down airplanes. And why various terrorist groups really want to focus on aviation is somewhat mysterious to me, but they really do. And that problem requires an ongoing security nimbleness on the part of government agencies that aren't used to being nimble in order to repel. I think, you know, we all get annoyed at TSA because, let's face it, they're really annoying. And getting onto an airplane now, especially for those of us who are old enough to remember how easy it used to be, is an aggravating process. But I actually think at the end of the day, that is a story that we should all be sort of reassured about, that we still get to use commercial air travel in relative freedom, and we get to be alive at the other end of the trip. And
Gabriella, as you think about the future of violence, what is the one thing about which you worry the most?
I worry about failed states, which is, again, connecting your previous conversation. I worry about ungoverned spaces. I worry about the failure of no country, no agency can protect everyone against everyone else. You have to rely on subcontractors. And the way we thought about these subcontractors is local governments and local police forces and local security agencies, whether they're within your own country or elsewhere. The more ungoverned spaces we see, and we see a weakening of the state structure all around the Middle East and elsewhere, this is my biggest concern. I think this is the major security challenge of our time. I think it means that the more powerful governments, the United States and others, have a real security interest in helping weaker countries build capacity, build effective governance structures. We used to think about it as a benevolent act to assist other countries in helping their own citizens and providing essential services and access to the very basic needs of survival and life. Now, if you don't want to think about it in terms of benevolence, think about it in terms of complete self-interest.
Let's go to Colette in Catlettsburg, Kentucky. You're on the air. Oh, thank you. Go right ahead, please.
So I am so excited you're covering this subject because it's really important. I think we should not underestimate the importance of this. I think there should be more. I get upset because of the rules and regulations far behind the flooding of these drones into the public. I think two of the rules should be no stealth capabilities to the public and always with running lights. Even though I'm blind and it's kind of lost on me, I have no doubt my neighbor has been binge peeping for quite a while.
So, look, the drone debate is a fascinating area because on the one hand, if you exclude, you know, the sort of hypothetical spider drone that we started with, that's at least some years off into the future. Most drones are perfectly harmless uses by hobbyists and sometimes by companies or would-be companies. The FAA still has a ways to go in that, to deliver interesting services and some of them potentially very life-saving. There are a few big issues about drones. One is air safety, you know, and we are talking about for the first time loosing very large numbers of flying objects into the sky by people who do not have the training of a commercial or recreational pilot's license. And that's never happened before. And how you maintain a safe environment, quite apart from any bad acts that anybody might do with a drone, just accidents, things falling out of the sky,
sure,
things colliding
sure
with other things in the sky. That's a very challenging problem that a lot of people at the FAA have been working very hard on.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It would seem that the technology has gotten out in front of the regulations.
Way out in front.
Way out.
Way out in front. And the caller raises a subsidiary set of issues, which is the set of issues around privacy. If everybody, you know, can fly a drone that has a pretty good camera on it, you're going to have many of the same privacy issues that you have with everybody walking around with a camera studio in their pocket, you know, our cell phones, only much more remote, right? So you can take pictures of people who are not within your line of sight. And a lot of people are very anxious about that. And so you have big safety issues, you have big privacy issues, and that's before you get to the issues that Gabby and I are thinking about, which is what does the really evil person do with this technology once they have the ability?
And finally, Gabby, what does this mean in terms of international law? How do we govern across borders?
So again, traditionally, we thought of the state's power as largely ending at its geographical boundary. So the boundary was not just a geographical boundary, it was also the outer line of the state's power. Internally, the state can do pretty much everything within certain bounds, but is sovereign to regulate the relationship between itself and the citizens, among the citizens, private companies, what's lawful, what's not lawful, what requires licensing, what can be censored, what's public domain, etc. But outside its borders, every other country is also sovereign. This is the principle of sovereign equality. All countries in the world are sovereign to determine their own laws and their own regulations and their own policies within their borders. Now that we live in an era where anything that happens outside my boundaries can easily affect me, it, of course, is not the first time this is true, but it's true now to a new magnitude,
right,
a new order. This principle of limiting my power at the border is not going to be viable, at least not as far as the very powerful countries are concerned. They're not going to stand for it, very, very simply. And they're going to insist on extending and projecting their power outside. So it could be done through just legislating laws that reach way outside our borders, which we already do in some contexts, like material support for terrorism or through the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, but just extending your regulation almost globally, all the way through surveillance to the very pernicious targeted killings and taking unilateral actions outside our boundaries.
There is a lot going on that we're not even aware of. Thank you both so much. Benjamin Witt is Gabriella Blum. Their new book is titled The Future of Violence. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Diane,
for having us.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.